I wish to thank church administration for suggesting coming out to this area on the 16th of January. I'm sure they anticipated the weather as well. We were planning to be here slightly ahead of time, but the radiator overheated, so I had to take care of that small matter, in or out of the rain in this case. I should like to mention that I have asked Mr. Wayan on a phone call whether any of you would like some apples that my wife and I came into possession of. Mr. Gene Michael regularly for the staff in Pasadena makes arrangements with a grower to provide several varieties, three or four, I do not know, but I'm in possession of pippins, which are good for cooking, and in possession of, they're good for eating too, but I think they do especially well for that, and Granny Smith's, more commonly, a new and a delightful variety for fresh eating. So there are two boxes, one of each. They're in the car, and I'll be happy to bring them to the lobby later. For the present, anyway, you can anticipate which you might like. I did not bring sacks for everybody, but I'm sure there are means of choosing those. What happened is that individuals who had committed themselves to the purchase, Mr. Michael called two or three times in some cases, and they simply chose not to. And it made no sense to leave them this long weekend. They've been there all week. On that basis, it was much better simply to purchase them from him. I will take some tomorrow morning to the Thai temple, where the monks have graciously asked to commemorate the 7th anniversary of the death of Herbert W. Armstrong. So I'll be there, Mr. Leon Sexton, possibly my wife, and it's always the appropriate thing to bring some gift of that nature. You remember a number of them were at the funeral, January 19, in 1986. Today, being what it is, it's valuable sometimes to reflect on how the church came to be, where it is, and what it is, and in the numbers that we are, having accomplished certain things over a period of little more than half a century, and ask why it is done at some times and not other times. For example, we would certainly be able to say that in the last half of this century, the work of the worldwide Church of God is known far and wide. But when Abraham Lincoln was looking for an answer to the question, who is actually keeping the commandments of God, he couldn't find the church. In fact, the Church of God, among whom Herbert W. and Loma D. Armstrong came in the later 1920s, from the middle on, had not even formally organized until 1862. And the Civil War had already begun. Of all the presidents of the United States, you might remember, there was only one who was never affiliated with a religious group, and that was Abraham Lincoln. And he said he would join a church when he found one that was willing to obey what God said. God called him for a purpose at an earlier time, but didn't choose to give him an answer to that question. But how is it that from time to time the power of the church is much greater than at other times. Perhaps we should take a look throughout the Bible and learn from a few examples, because the history of the Church of God, in a sense, mirrors, but on a different plane, the history of the nation of Israel. There you had a nation whose roots were in a particular land. Today we have people from all nations whose roots are scattered far and wide. It is not a nation state, but a church. That nation state was also a church. I had an experience with my wife this last Festival of Tabernacles, where we celebrated it in Eugene, Oregon. I do not know how many of you were there from time to time in the past, since the festival has been held there. But I should like to pose a question that we could ask time and again historically. But this one I have seen visually. Why did the church that we now know as the Worldwide Church of God develop out of the Oregon Conference of the Church of God Seventh Day in the Willamette Valley, and from 1934 in January to 1986, or 52 years, span the world, reaching some of the most primitive kinds of people, though not necessarily primitive in mind, known among educators, kings, archaeologists, professional people, the business world, certainly the world of radio and television? How is it that something like this happened in 52 years and should have begun not in London, certainly not in Jerusalem? Why didn't it happen, in fact, in California? Why Oregon? Why not where the church had its largest groups in the eastern half of the United States, in such small places as Stanbury, Missouri, or Salem, West Virginia? We had a chance to do something that I had not done before, even though I had visited the Eugene area some 40 years ago. I had never been in the area of the three congregations, but only the one. We think of Eugene as the church that gave rise, or the congregation that gave rise to the work, because it was the people in that congregation whose monies ultimately made the difference in terms of the World Tomorrow program and the magazine and other literature. But the Eugene Church was a combination of three smaller congregations going back to 1933. One was in Jeans, one at Alvador, and the other at Eugene. I had never been out to this area. I might just ask, for reasons that you might like to talk to such individuals here later, how many of you have been to see the area of Jeans and Alvador outside of Eugene? All right, there, you might take a look, some of you who are nearby those. What was remarkable to me is not the situation at Jeans so much today, because where the old schoolhouse, where the church met, could be anticipated, you were really looking at a lake. It has been altered, and the old building has been moved, and it is now a private house. It was once a larger building, and now is in two parts. They divided it and moved it, and it's a private residence. But all around that area is a significant amount of water, so much so that by damming an area, there is a lake and the building was moved, and small farms and private residences. Alvador might perhaps be a little more to the point. The old school building is a private residence today, but all around the area, from Eugene out to this area, you notice something special, a great diversity of farming, trees, livestock, root crops, certainly hay. Next to the Alvador School is one of the largest nurseries, plant-growing nurseries, that I have seen, is certainly the largest in Oregon that I am familiar with. It doesn't mean it is the largest there, and I'm not making that statement. But it's quite impressive. Several times we went out to that area in order to understand what had happened. The largest number of people in the church in the 1930s and before were centered in areas such as Oklahoma and Missouri and as far east as West Virginia, Ohio. I'm not mentioning all the regions, but in what we would call the Midwest. It was not centered in the American South to the same extent. In the early days, the largest group had, in fact, developed out of the region from New York west, New Jersey west. They had come into what we call Middle America and the border state of Missouri, the new territory of Oklahoma. But in the 1930s, this area was, especially Oklahoma, where so many of the members were, and other areas where the church was not, came to be known as the Dust Bowl. But my wife grew up in the area of Oklahoma and the panhandle of Texas, and she has some interesting photographs and memories, far more vital even than photographs, of what it was like. We haven't seen anything since the 1930s of this nature. It was a disaster, an absolute disaster. The American government even sent some fine photographers to record the tragedy of this part of the area of the United States. What was needed was an area where you would have what we might call a religious background that was open-minded, the people of varied religious backgrounds, but open-minded, and you would have to have individuals who were able to earn a living and to be able to support a work to be done. You would also have to be in a country which gave free access to radio. Television was not then extant. Our British brethren often ask, why did God ever start this work in the United States? After all, Britain is more important. And in the world scene, the British Empire certainly played a more important role than the American Commonwealth has, up to the time of essentially the Second World War. Well, the first answer is obvious. Britain, even to this day, does not allow us on radio or television on British stations. It's a government-controlled medium, this matter of broadcasting by one of the other means. So it couldn't start there, and you have, I don't even have to go over the rest of the country. It would make no sense to start in an area so underpopulated as Australia. You have to start in an area where there is the capacity, and you would have to start in a large country where the media of television later and radio at first were accessible. But it didn't start in the great city, let's say, of New York or Chicago. Cities of that nature were not the place that you might have expected such a work to begin. cities tend to have another life. And religion has not been known to be fundamentally characteristic of the great cities of the United States. The people who were there tended to be, in significant numbers, Catholic and Jewish, and also quite secular. In fact, if we were to look back to even 1960 in the Worldwide Church of God, we would find that the largest number of people, some 25 and more years after this work began, still lived in small towns, rural communities, on the farm, and it was a small town church. It has changed a great deal, as the United States has, but if I were to ask you here, I would conclude that on average, still, half of the people in the Church of God today, no matter where they lived, have roots that go back to small towns, rural America, and the farm. This is simply the reality. I won't say that that would be true of New York City, but it is true of most all the congregations that I have been able to visit where we could pose such a question. Mr. Armstrong used to think of it in these terms. He said, farmers seem to be closer to God than other people. Now, what he really meant is farmers in the Willamette Valley. Because today, I don't know of any people who contribute as a percentage less than the farming community today. Farmers today are simply preoccupied with making a living and a part of agribusiness. If you were to visit Iowa, for example, you would discover that in the farming state of Iowa, in one of the leading congregations where you would expect farmers to make a contribution, there is one member who earns a living on the farm. All the rest are urban-suburban membership. It's a changed world. But there was something important about being on the farm and not in the city, and something also important regarding the Willamette Valley. As I said, it was a diversified farming community, not merely corn, hog bellies, soybeans, which later developed in greater number, or wheat. It wasn't a monocrop region. It was an area in which people could make significant amounts of money. Even if one crop failed, there was always the possibility of another. Now, I think you need to see this aspect. This is quite different than the story of the Apostle Paul's work in the Greek-speaking world in the first century, where the last place he wanted to go was in the countryside. And he went from city to city, all the important towns, because that's where the Jewish nation was. The Jews were not farming in the Roman countryside. They were living and trading and bringing to the attention of the Greeks the religion that God had given their ancestors. But the people who were Bible reading in the 1920s and 30s were people who generally were more rural in orientation. But I could have said that everything that I found in the Willamette Valley, I could have found where I grew up in Northern California. But there was one difference. We had water. We never lacked money like the people in Arkansas did. We had no drought. We had relative prosperity. The farmers there could certainly have supported the work of God. But you'd be surprised, the people were different. I grew up and attended schools in which, for practical purposes, in some cases, the entire class I was with were bilingual. Or in other cases, practically everyone was bilingual. They spoke Portuguese, Italian, Hungarian. There were German Austrians and Germans from Germany, Poles and Russians, Jews and Scandinavians, and Irish. And I was even in a class where there wasn't a single person with an Anglo-Saxon name other than an Irishman. And the religion, Protestant to some extent, certainly Catholic, Russian Orthodox, Jewish. That was not the basis. That could not have been the basis. So what is remarkable is that circumstantially, Herbert W. Armstrong, with the talents and training and advertising, came out to the one place, unknown to him, where on the West Coast the Church of God had found the greatest opportunity to develop, and the Oregon Conference was certainly considered the most prosperous and vital of the conferences of the Church of God Seventh Day in the 1920s and 30s. So you have a picture that on occasion, even in a depression, it is possible to prosper. I can illustrate a point of prosperity because many of the younger generation, or two generations, you know, there's some of us who are under 20 and some who are under 40, 45. People who have not been in a depression from time to time have commented quite mistakenly when they hear that a loaf of bread was so cheap or a dozen eggs only cost so much or a pair of shoes. And the mistaken statement, it's hard for me to understand, the mistaken statement that is made is, oh, money must not have had much value then. Which is, in fact, just the opposite if they even thought it through. But, you know, nickels and dimes, quarters, 50 cents, a dollar, that seems so inconsequential today. But let me illustrate a point. Would money be worth more or less if at one time it cost you one dime for a loaf of bread and another time 10 dimes? Did you know which period the value of money is worth 10 times as much as the other? I'm making it simple for those of you who are not math teachers. When you can buy a loaf of bread for 10 cents, that 10-cent piece is worth 10 times as much as when you have to spend 10 such pieces for the same loaf of bread. Now, isn't that logical? And that's exactly what has happened. Mr. Armstrong was able, and not by his own money, but by the brethren, to have a radio broadcast once a week, half an hour, that cost $2.50. Don't tell me money was not valuable. It was so valuable that all you needed was $2.50 for a half hour on radio. Inflation has made a great deal of difference. So we could say in this generation, the work began in the midst of a depression. Now, some would draw the conclusion that this is the most illogical time to have begun a work. But in fact, that's not the case at all. to say it would have been easy would be a mistake. But the fact is, in a depression where you do not have inflation, and remember today we have a minimum of inflation and we're trying to reduce in the world the salaries by when you terminate them from one place, then they have to go to another with a lower salary. We have minimal inflation. But in that day, there was no inflation. And money became more and more valuable because the amount of goods produced tended to exceed the amount of money put into circulation. And therefore, fewer and fewer dollars in the marketplace were competing for goods, which tended to drive the price of goods down. In which case, there were obviously businesses you didn't want to be in, but the one business that necessarily was very important was the business of providing you something to eat. It's called farming. My father he had a chicken ranch. I grew up on a chicken ranch in Northern California. On average, in the Depression of the 1930s, we made $1 per chicken. By 1942, with the development of World War II and the need for eggs, he was making only 10 cents per bird. He needed, in other words, 10 times as many birds, but that wouldn't have made any difference because they take 10 times as much food. Only later have the farm prices in terms of other prices not risen. My wife and I have a few chickens and we buy grain. And the astonishing thing, and of course her relatives in the panhandle of Texas, Oklahoma, in the panhandle of Oklahoma, the price they're getting for grain today is only minimally more, considering the value of the dollar. The price itself is minimally more than it was 60 years ago. Farming doesn't pay today. It simply does not. Farming, if you knew what you were doing, paid in the Depression. And therefore, the church was, in a sense, built on people who farmed. And those were the people who also read the Bible, because it wasn't easy, but it was, in all likelihood, something that made you dependent on God because of the weather. And so, a people who were interested in religion, and a group of people who were already church members, the Church of God in those days, had come among them a man who was trained in advertising, how to sell an idea. And that's really the story of why it developed in Oregon. And it can only develop in a depression, this kind of work, when the value of the money, the value of currency, was so significant that it bought so much more than we think of today. Essentially, today we have to have not an income of $6,000, we have to have an income of $60,000 to live as people did then with $6,000 from the Depression till now. So that if you hear that your parents earned $4,000, you think they were poor. No, they merely had a limited amount of technology. But if they were having to make a living today comparably, they would at least have to earn $40,000 and live no better in terms of standards other than the question of the availability of different technology. That's the reality. Now, what happens when you are at the bottom and a work starts where money has value, well, you are able to go through, let's say, one door and another, one radio station and another, and the money's kept coming in. Now, a very important point to be borne in mind is that when you have hit bottom, as the Depression was, things generally have only one way to go. It's called looking up, going up. Gradually, as a result of the low point was 1937, and then there were some scares that were already making people think. In Europe, in 1938, and by 1939, there was a war, and by 1941, there was a real war affecting the United States, and now monies started to flow. Inflation slowly began, but there was price control. And people were being paid, and people saved. They didn't have very much to spend. That is, they were supposed to put it in savings bonds. But they didn't have that much to spend money on, and people began to accumulate money. So what happened is that the economy began to rise, although it was distorted through 1945 and the war. For example, the Brethren could not meet at the Festival of Tabernacles until after the war was over in 1945. Was not until essentially 1946 when it was possible to have enough fuel and have tires that would enable Brethren to go to Belknap Springs from Eugene and the other towns in Oregon and Washington. Nevertheless, things were prospering. Now, the way to look at it is something like this. If the work is going to grow, you start to invest in it at the bottom of the cycle. You get what I mean? Because as the economy grows and as the amount of work that needs to be done is also therefore to grow, it should grow as the economy grows. More and more people who listen will be prospering more and more, and generally speaking, the income will exceed the outgo because there is the need with more purchasing power to create jobs, to build the factories, to produce the goods for which the money was available but unspent during the war, 1941-1945. How is it possible to accomplish what we did in 52 years from 34 to 86? The answer is the work grew and expanded at the time the economy was on the upswing. If you were to take the waves of the sea, you know, and just draw a line like this and go up and down, you would discover that if you treat that as an economic wave, we call it a long wave, that every time there is a recession, the bottom of the recession, as you come up the wave, because on the wave are little ups and downs as well, the bottom of most recessions will be higher than the previous low, and the tops will generally be significantly higher than the previous high, the top being the next leg up in the economy. Now, it wasn't easy. It was not until around 1958 that enough production had occurred, enough production, that there was enough money flowing that it was possible to expand enough, also through Ambassador College with the manpower, womanpower, to begin to make significant strides. Remember 34 to 53, before we even went to Europe, and we really didn't get very far economically. It was still tough until about 1958. And then it tended to be more satisfactory. It is not easy to come out of a war. You have a certain amount of inflation, and then you have the shock value when sometimes the economy takes a dip. It tended to be stable by the 50s, but it was moving up without any question during the period of Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, and Dwight D. Eisenhower. Today, it is the opposite. We are on the downturn, and way down on the downturn. So that every time the economy rises today, it generally rises less high than in a previous blip on the long wave. And when it drops, it tends to drop lower than a previous low. This is a very important thing for us to realize, that this work could have been built only in a period of time when it was possible for people essentially for a long time to have more money than there were goods available, other than food in the Depression, because then there were more goods than money, but it was soon, as a result of the war, more money than goods. And it stabilized afterward, after some 12 or 13 years. But there was general prosperity beginning to spread in the world. We were bailing Europe out. Bailing, in a sense, Europe was more important than bailing Japan. But Japan was slowly going to grow, even if it took till 1972 to begin to break into the American market. But Europe was beginning to grow and beginning to prosper step by step, but ever so slowly. And it really was not until 1972 that Germany and Japan were able to truly be competitive on the world scene. And then only on a small scale, but at least they now became competitive. Prosperity. Building. People needed to have a house in which to live. More food. The population was growing. So it was possible for this work to accomplish what it did, because it started at the low point in the economy among people who were diversified in means of producing monies and who were interested in the Bible and, in fact, who were, in some cases, several generations of members in the churches of God in the United States. And so it was that we had the opportunity with a man responsible for the direction of the work of the church under Jesus Christ, who was trained in concepts of advertising. That doesn't mean that those concepts may not at times have been expressed in superlatives when quieter terms might have been wiser. But the reality is that it was an age in which people spoke forth. It was not the age of quiet bureaucrats. Mussolini spoke from the balconies of Italy, and in particular Rome, to the Italian nation. Adolf Hitler was flying from place to place, whether in a car or a plane. He was moving, and addressing the nation. Churchill was writing, but the British didn't want to pay much attention to it. And the worldwide Church of God, then known as the Radio Church of God, began to spread. And by 1944, I, for the first time, heard the work on WOAI San Antonio, Texas, when living in Northern California. In fact, Mr. Armstrong got on radio stations sometimes in the United States, but primarily on stations in Mexico. Because they were relatively inexpensive. And the Mexicans had no problem with English being broadcast in a nation that wasn't even all Spanish-speaking, certainly hardly English-speaking, where many peoples were still speaking native American Indian languages. In fact, when people from Mexico were brought to the state of California to harvest the land from Oaxaca in Mexico, the entire group spoke Oaxacan, and only one person in the leadership spoke Spanish. Mexico has come a long way also in that period of time, and our church has grown a great deal there. But these radio stations, whether in Texas, whether from Iowa, whether from Mexico in XELO, XEG going east, or in Southern California, Baja California, XELO, these were clear channel stations. In 1959, it was possible for the first time for the work of God to have a single broadcast, the program, on these clear channel stations at different times in a week and be heard by 29% of the nation at any one time. That doesn't mean that others could not have listened, but that's, in a sense, what was happening. With the same expenditure of money in 1989, with no clear channel stations, and with the cost of television, I'm not talking about the same monies, but the same value of money, the same kind of investment that would be equivalent 30 years later from 59 to 89, the same effort would produce an audience not 29% of the nation, which is a little short of one-third, but produce an audience that could be heard, that could hear the program and respond, which figure would be only 2.9%. The costs are such today that it is possible with the same comparable amount of effort, Mr. David Hume has presented this material to us, with the same effort, we can do only one-tenth as much today because there are no clear channel stations anymore. It was a time in those 50s and 60s when it was possible to accomplish what today is impossible for us. People think that the time to invest is when things are going good. The time to invest is when things have yet to go good. You know, you want to get on the ground, the floor. And that's what happened in the Depression. The work began when everything was on the bottom. And all that could happen was that it could go up and up and up. And so it is truly a remarkable half century that, in a sense, we commemorate 52 years, now 7 years since then. By that time, we had essentially reached, and we could say by 1986 to 88, the top had been clearly reached and had already flattened out of a wave like this, or if you're looking at it the other way, whichever wave direction your waves flow. We had gone from the bottom to the crest. Now what remained was to go down and down and down in the economy. It is inevitable, because there was a time the economy was higher than the Depression, and it you've all heard of the crash of 1929, and that's when it began to go down and down and down. And it took a long time to come out from the end of the 20s to the end of the 50s. It was almost a kind of 30 years from 29 to 58. That period, let's say, would represent this aspect. But the crest that I am talking about didn't start then. It has expanded from the 60s to the 70s to the middle of the 80s. But by that time, it was no longer going up. It was already flat. More and more jobs at smaller and smaller salaries were being made available during the remarkable Reagan period. President Bush had the honor of presiding over the clear decline of the American economy, and it has slid off very significantly. There were warning signs in 73, 74, 79 to 82, clear warning signs up and down. But once 1989 had arrived, there isn't any question the economy has simply slidden down as the crest has gone down, whichever direction. And we are at a period near the bottom. In rather rapid order, this has been a comparatively sharp drop because of the debt load. And each time the economy bounces back, it is coming back at a lower level, and each time it is now going down, it is going down a little lower than the previous level. Now, we're not talking about the other side of the crest. It was way tragedy in earlier depressions. We're merely saying that as it goes down the slope, the bottom here, the top, the bottom, the top, the bottom, it's going down, 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 and the tops are lower and lower and lower when it's going up. Now, we're going in a little upward movement. But President Clinton is going to have to face the reality that before his 4 years are over, with the death of Herbert Armstrong, Joseph Tkach became responsible for presiding over the work during a time in which prosperity was contracting. This is simply the reality of the world around us. This is why, since the high point of the work, the actual monies that have come into the work by the end of this year will have declined by some 20% in value worldwide. This has nothing to do with management. You know, if it were poorly managed, the figure would be much higher. But the fact remains that more and more of the membership, as I have elsewhere explained, die of old age or retire in the interim at the high point of their income productivity. And more people are being added to the church at the bottom end of the economic ladder while they are in their 20s or 30s or 40s. You see, in those days, we even had the unusual situation that on average, the age of people coming into the church was centered somewhere in the, let's say, 40s and 50s. Whereas now, the age of people who are becoming members is somewhere in the 20s. That's the average. The largest group of people who are added to the church are children of church members who were baptized before they're 30. And they become members at the least productive economic level of their lives, while going out at the top are those who are the most productive to retirement, aging. You know, people we baptized, I met people in 1953, let's say that was 40 years ago on a baptizing tour. Suppose they were then 40 years of age, they would now be 80 years of age. they were their most productive for the next 20 to 30 years. They're not now. I met many people who were 50s and 60s, and some were in their 70s in those days. But it's a different thing today. Fewer and fewer as a percent are converted in old age or even middle age. And the world's economy is reflecting this same trend. The Japanese bubble has burst. The Germans have been burdened with now adding that part that was East Germany, which functioned. We thought it was a kind of communist small state superpower, and it turned out ultimately to have collapsed about the time the Russians withdrew. In other words, Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union essentially have collapsed. And instead of Germany having a huge market in Eastern Europe, it is a wasteland, an economic wasteland. The rate of inflation right now is 2,500% in Russia per year. Do you know what that means? That to keep your standard of living, when you made a dollar last year, you need $2,500 this year just to keep pace. The savings are gone. It's a tragedy. Because, and well, that's another sermon. So that's the story of communism. The Chinese are not making this mistake. China never made the basic mistakes that the Soviet Communist Party did. But Mr. Tkach's responsibility should be focused on and yours. This is the time in which we have to realize that much of the prosperity that occurred beginning with World War II and through the Reagan years was in fact created by a government policy significantly in Congress of always having the wondrous skill of spending more than you took in. It's called debt. And so the debt is now so extensive, especially during the Reagan years, was it increased, and especially earlier in Carter's time. In other words, it's been mounting and mounting. What President Carter did was to increase debt significantly more than it had been increased by any Democratic administration since Franklin Roosevelt. In a sense, the war with Russia was won as a result of what was spent during the Reagan years. But remarkably, the 4 short years of President Bush added to debt as much as all the debt that had gone before in the previous 3 administrations, the 2 under Reagan and the 1 under Carter. And that is due to the fact that when you decide that you no longer need to spend money for the military, you don't reach for all the dividends. People thought that if you stop spending money for the military, there would be immense amount of money available for dividends. And they were planning to spend these dividends here and there. They never thought of this, that if you don't spend money for the military, all those who worked in that capacity are unemployed. And they're paying no taxes. Now they begin to pay taxes again if they can get employment, but you have to retrain them. And when they're now temporarily being laid off step by step, they're no longer buying goods, and so you don't have to manufacture the goods, and the economy drops accordingly because there's nobody buying those goods. Now, it is not that serious, but what we are presently able to survive. But we are on the downslope. We have more office space than we need in this country and in many places of the world. We have factories not producing at the level that they could. The potential of overproduction is there. The businessmen are shrewd enough not to overproduce. They simply cut the working force. So Mr. Tkach's function is how to be more efficient at a time when the income, in fact, is inevitably dropping by the nature of the economy around us and an aging church at the top and a younger church at the bottom, you see, expanding. But that's at the lower economic level. Everyone, in my judgment, in the foundation, Ambassador College or the church, has done excellently. I would say the efficiency of the work certainly is reflected in what has still been accomplished in the stability of the number of members in the church. Is not growing, but it is essentially stable. It is slightly declining because of the fact that the large number of people who came into the church in the 70s and late 60s have reached that point where the death ratio per membership is higher than it used to be, by far. There was a time practically no one, I remember, we could get by in a whole year in the church and no one had died. The obituary column of 1993 is not like what it was in 1953. That was rare. Auto accidents, perhaps, yes. But apart from that, well, those things are simply built in. We have to bear those in mind. So Mr. Tkach expects people to improve in their thinking, their willingness to work, to avoid unnecessary raises. We have, in certain cases, upgraded people who needed to be, but those that haven't needed to be have not been upgraded for a number of years. Mr. Armstrong was not the kind of person who could manage this situation. He was an advertising person, and he was the man to lead the work during the time that prosperity was growing. He was not a trained financier. He said he never had training in finances. So it was a situation, a remarkable one, that the right person was there for that critical period from the 30s through the 80s. And there was a man who was being trained in the church, who had experience in World War II as a young man, who was a manager, whereas Mr. Armstrong was a loner. Any advertising man is essentially a loner. I mean, he's sitting at his desk writing copy. Mr. Armstrong knew that that was the kind of person he was. He wasn't a team man. He had to learn how to work with a team. He was the lone voice this side of the microphone, the lone person at the typewriter, the lone person editing the copy, the lone person, so to speak. There were always agents in dealing with radio and later television. Mr. Tkach grew up as a team man in the union movement. He has to have team effort. Because now we must make the money from the Philippines, the money from Canada, the money from Germany, the money from Britain, South Africa, go further and further. Because the church is growing in some areas, like the Philippines. The church is growing in areas as in Africa. The Philippines is an exception. Africa is not. The Philippines essentially is holding its own or prospering. But Africa is a disaster continent. It's an economic disaster, and it's a political disaster. Haiti is a disaster, and we have a remarkable impact in the island of Haiti and among the brethren. In this highly technical world, Africa has been playing a lesser role and a lesser role year by year. And therefore, it costs more and more to take care of these third world countries, as they have been called, or developing countries. They are not adequately developing. That is a nice name, but it doesn't mean anything. It is untrue. Somalia is an illustration of a political disaster. Mozambique is a political disaster. Zaire is a political disaster. Angola is a political disaster, and Ethiopia is a political disaster, and the Sudan is a political disaster, and shall I continue? We have members in Zaire. Inflation is frightful. So we have to see that monies are spread to take care of vast areas of the world where the ability to engender capital is declining. You see, in the 1970s, to illustrate the point, we told the farmers that if they would buy more land and produce more food, that we would be able to feed more hungry people. No one ever told the farmer that the hungry people had no money to buy the food. You could borrow the money, and that's why so many farmers went broke when the farmland bubble burst. They simply had no one at the other end to pay. Because the poor in Africa can't afford it. They simply can't afford. And you can say the Japanese certainly can afford it, but there are only 125 million of them. There's 750 million in Africa. Oh yes, there were countries who could afford to. The Russians for a while could. Latin America became a disaster area, fundamentally for economic and political reasons. So we are in a situation where we have to cut back in the Spanish-speaking world. Britain simply cannot do what it did before in Africa. Australia cannot do what it did before for the South Pacific and Southeast Asia. Canada cannot do for the Philippines, but happily the Philippines is one of the few bright spots in what we call the developing world. It just happens to be a responsive country. It's one of the most responsive of all countries in the world. That is, if you were to take the largest church groups, you would name the United States, Canada, Britain, Australia. I'm not trying to specify the area. But after the United States, there are four countries that are essentially at the same level. Britain, Canada, Australia, and the Philippines. France is not. Germany is not. Italy is not. No other country. All the other countries are a fraction the size of these four, and they together are a fraction the size of this land in terms of the impact of a nation on the population and the church. Your job today, I think before this day is over, to realize that we have a responsibility to make money go further. We have a responsibility to help people who need help, in the church as well as outside. This is a very important thing, that we have reached a point where the government of the United States now has to have help. We were once the largest creditor nation. Now we are the largest debtor nation in the world. And that happened in only a matter of a very few years. This must be resolved. Now is the time to learn how to accumulate more capital resources to hold the debt or reduce it, to be in a position where you can always survive, or to put yourself in that position if you were not. To extend help to those who have need. To learn to work with people who sometimes get into serious trouble, in or out of the church, but especially in, we're talking about, with the abuse of alcohol. I don't know if that's a problem in this congregation or not. But it is a problem for some. And it is a costly problem. Because people who do that in general also do not adequately concern themselves with their obligations to others. We need to give serious consideration to the importance of Ambassador College, as Mr. Takach has, as well as locally Imperial Schools for the specific region, which is to say we need to give serious consideration for education, for young people, so that any contribution you make is proportionately higher than would be made if you had not educated and trained yourself, because your contributions become more and more important. Now there is, of course, the spiritual need. The spiritual need is to understand that there are always those people, few in number, just a small percentage, all taken together, but that small percentage can be the equivalent of what should have been growth. And so we have those who depart for whatever reason. They do not know that if they look through the history of the people that God called, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that Jacob took a long time to face up to the reality of his life. Then the children of Israel took a long time to face reality in the 40 years in the wilderness. And there were ups and downs in the time of the judges. But we need to read this not just as history, but to recognize that God used one people ultimately to preserve this book. And many of them left, and only Judah remained, with the other tribe of Benjamin and Levi, but primarily Levi, and fragments just of the others, but it was centered on the house of Judah. If you were to look at the story of the judges, I'm sure there were people then who would have argued we ought to leave Israel and go somewhere else, but where would they have gone to? What other nation had God revealed himself to? What other nation was willing to listen, or ever has been? Then under the kings. Finally, you know what happened. The house of Israel broke away, and they never had a king who brought them back. Judah had its problems. Judah had its problems. But Judah had leadership that brought the nation back from time to time. I don't have to name them, you should know. Josiah at the end, Hezekiah earlier, certainly Jehoshaphat, Asa before. And even when Judah went into captivity, they were willing to come to themselves and preserved the book, and Christ came among them, he could not have fulfilled the Word of God and come in China, or been reared in an African society or an American Indian society. Whatever the value of their culture, they were missing that spiritual element that was found only in Judah. And that was a remarkable day, the building of the church in the New Testament, because it was a time, unlike earlier times, when it was possible to be in one land, a citizen of one realm, and to go from Britain in the west to the borders of Parthia, or what we would call Persia today. That they're not equivalent. The Parthians were a different people, but they dominated the region of Persia. To go from Britain to Persia, to go all across North Africa, to go to the Rhineland and Holland in the north, to go to the Black Sea, the Danube, to go throughout modern Turkey, which is now not accessible to us, to go up the Nile a significant distance to Ethiopia, to have access to the Arab world and beyond, to be able to trade with Sri Lanka, to trade along the Silk Route to China, and to go beyond. There was never a world like that of the New Testament. But it was a world in which Paul, the leader in the Greek-speaking area, which meant the Roman world, he was able to go from city to city. That was where the merchants were. It was an age of commerce. Farming was critically important, as at all times, but that was not fundamental where money was made. It was made in merchandising and trade and shipping. There is a parallel, but quite different. It was possible for Paul to do certain things that it was impossible before. And then later on, the Roman Empire collapsed, and I'm, of course, moving centuries downstream, and then it was no longer possible to travel. The church tended to be centered in the Christian region of Armenia and neighboring countries, then in the Balkans, and then in the Alps, and then in the British Isles, and finally it tended to center in Rhode Island and the Northeast, and then in the Midwest. In those days, there was darkness in much of the world. It was not like the Roman world. As small as it might have been, it was by far the most dominant area of the world. Suddenly, in looking at communications, to add one final thought, radio develops in our age, and television, and flying by the airplane. We take for granted. In fact, there are many people in the church now who are over 20. And let's say beginning this year, there will be individuals who will be practically a quarter of a century old and will have lived only during a time when they will think of it as historic that man also landed on the moon and walked on it. That's something for us to think about. And many who are older than that, who really have no consciousness of a world, even though they were born before, of a world other than that which man has created as a result of these space vehicles that take us in part to the moon, or enable us to travel without human beings out to the far-flung planets. So it was possible for this work to have offices all around the world, like in the Roman Empire. Possible to have offices all around the world and communicate by air not merely by ship. My mother's father came across this country. My mother's mother's father came from New York to Los Angeles by boat before the Panama Canal was built. It took 6 months of one's life. That was a different world. He called, you know, the ship called in all the major ports in the Caribbean and Eastern and Western South America, Mexico to California. The ability to communicate today has also been enhanced by the fax machine. It's been enhanced by the duplicator. When I first came to Ambassador College, if I wanted another copy, I had to have a carbon. And we made two carbons, and you could make two copies. The idea of doing the things that we do now, and duplicating whatever we want to, sending messages, telephones, of course, have been here for a while, but to be able to reach people all around the world by these means of communication, that was something unique. But today, despite all these things being available, they're becoming more and more sophisticated, costing more and more. They don't represent the practically no increase in inflation. There are more and more, there's more than more and more sophistication. It costs us more and more in these areas affecting media. And that means that we have to be very careful. This work can increase its income despite the situation if we all take seriously to make ourselves responsible for cutting unnecessary outgo. There is a time to be hospitable and gracious. We're not talking that that is wrong. But a time to be as conservative as possible. To know that you don't have to shop in Beverly Hills, you could, in fact, visit Salvation Army. Or, if I may say so, that's where I bought my last shoes. Somebody had feet like mine. And instead of $90 for a pair of men's shoes, $5 was quite a price to pay. It's amazing what you can save if you think about it. Let us support Mr. Takacs's leadership. Let us work together as a team and recognize there have been difficulties all along. In the history of the people God called, that's what the New Testament letters of Paul are all about. Working with the difficulties within and without. But the one thing we cannot do is allow the work to be divided and scattered. It must hold together. And we need to learn to be generous, spiritually minded. Not talking monetarily minded, though that is perhaps taken for granted, but generous in our thought and concern for others, for whatever differences or the degree to which we move along spiritually, some leading the pack, as you heard in the sermonette, and some following behind. There is no reason to stop and quit.